So welcome to another edition of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And this week we go back to the Somme, where I recorded an interview in Teepval Woods with Rocky from the Somme Association. Rocky doesn't work there, he's a volunteer. He spends several weeks each year out there with his wife Jo. Between them they run the cafe at the Ulster Tower, and then they run twice a day tours into the woods. And that's what we're going to do this week. We're going to go with Rocky into Teepval Woods and find out what there is there. Now, it was a cold, blustery day, as it often is up there on those ridges, when we went into the woods. We had a quick cup of tea in the Ulster Cafe. It was lovely, superbly made by Joe. And then Rocky takes us on this guided tour, not just of the woods, but of the site around the Ulster Cafe. And we look in detail at where the 36th Ulster Division attacked on the 1st of July 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme. We're going to take you on a virtual tour of the German front line into the woods where the Ulster Division formed up and attacked from. And to start with, we join Rocky in the garden of the Ulster Tower where he sets the scene. And he does that by explaining the layout of the battlefield and how the Germans had built their strong defences here between 1914 and 1916. And as we're talking about the Ulstermen, there's no one better really than to tell the story than Rocky. As you can hear, he tells the story with that wonderful Northern Irish accent. Let's go and see now what Rocky has got to say.
So the Germans were at the Nazis. They were here about 18 months prior to this battle. And they had obviously invaded. And as I say to people at this stage, armies don't come into a country, kill everybody in the north and make their way to the south. Probably the way the Israelis are doing now, but kill everybody and then that's the end of it. When you invade and you're moving forward, you have to consolidate the ground that you take, because you've got to bring supplies forward from your mother country. So what the Germans done, when they worked their way here, they consolidated in this area. And they built themselves into five lanes of defensive trenches, ready to defend this ground. While they got themselves sorted out, brought forward their supplies before they started moving on, which they eventually did. Now, what I will do, before I tell you what was there, I'll point out the German front line in relation to where we're standing.
Okay.
Okay, if you look to the far distance, you'll see a wooded area.
Yes.
That is Beaumont Hamel.
Okay.
That's where the Newfoundland Memorial is. If you go to the left edge of that wood, and in an imaginary line, come down into the valley towards the wee cemetery you see, keeping the farm on the left, the big farm.
Yeah.
Through the wee cemetery, Ancre Cemetery, and up into this field here. And where I'm pointing, just to the right of where them people are, you'll see a little white marker.
Yep.
Well, that is a German observation post.
Not a machine gun post.
Not a machine gun post, which a lot of people think it was. It was never a machine gun post. It's an German observation post on the front line.
Wow.
All it is there now is a bit of clump of rocks and a bit of metal. But so if you come through that little post and through round the back of our tower, and where I'm pointing now, you'll see a small cemetery.
Yes.
That is called Mill Road Cemetery.
Okay, yeah.
That is built on the German front line. So we're actually standing right in front, in no man's land, in front of the German front line.
Barbed wire where we're standing. Yeah.
Yes, this would have been part of no man's land. Mm. Now, not all lines of defence are big straight lines. So somewhere as it goes out, it'll swing to the right, and it will come in front of Teepval Village, because Teepval Village was under control of the Germans prior to this battle. So it sort of goes out and then comes round to the right. Now, going back that way, about a mile, just over a mile possibly, they had five lines of defensive trenches. If you look to the distant over on point, you'll see a small village, that's Beaucourt. Round to the right of that, and beyond, sort of in a straight line behind our wood, that is a village of Grandcourt, and that was roughly the back of the German fifth line. The German third line was a fortification called the Schwaben Redoubt. Redoubt being French for fortification. They had many here, but this one was particularly strong. And where the name came from, it was built by the Schwaben Reserve Regiment, who hailed from the Black Forest area in South Germany. So they were the ones that built that. Nearly all the soldiers here that fought here were reservists. So that's why it's called the Schwaben Redoubt. It was heavily fortified. They'd concreted the trenches in. They were about 25 foot down, and nobody was going to take that. That was their stop line if anybody got any further when the battle started. So the Schwaben Redoubt was the third line. They then had two more lines of defensive trenches going back about a mile. That's the Germans. Any questions on the Germans?
So why were they so deep? 25 feet. That's very deep.
The Germans were very good at digging in, and as I say, they were defending. They weren't attacking.
To stay, weren't
they? They were here. They consolidated here. They weren't giving this ground
and
up.
We're
different. They'll explain about us in a wee sack. So they were defensive trenches, and that's why they were dug so good. Okay, we're now going to look at the British side, and obviously I'm here to deal with the 36th Ulster Division, but I'll give you a rough idea of who was in this sector prior to this battle. So if you look directly to your front, you'll see a wooded area. That is Thiepval Wood, and it runs from the bottom of the hill off the memorial the whole way along the front and down to this side of the banks of the River Ancre. It's about 1,600 metres in length. And that is where the 36th Ulster Division were dug in two lines of attacking trenches. So we weren't here to defend.
They had five.
We were dug in, ready to attack here. And that's the big difference between the two. Mm. Yeah. So the 36th Ulster Division in Thiepval Wood. Now, out to the right, on the division's left, as we look at it, with an objective of Bowman Tommel, was the 29th Division, and they incorporated the Newfoundland Regiment. Mm-hmm. They also had English regiments. There was a battalion, a regiment, 1st Dublin Fusiliers were with them as well, and I think possibly an Enniskillen battalion. So the 29th Division, they were coming out over the open ground, high ground you see in the distance, and their first main objective was Bowman Tommel. And we'll talk a wee bit about that when we move down.
Okay.
On our right and the left as we look, with an objective of Thiepval Village, which is 32nd Division, and they incorporated battalions and regiments like the Manchesters, the Salford Pals, the Lancs were all in that. And they also had, I think, one battalion of the Royal Enniskillen Fusiliers.
The Irish were everywhere then.
Everywhere, even further on,
oh my word.
Even in the other division, I can't remember what the other division was beyond it, but they were there well.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the area. So the 32nd Division were there, and the 29th Division were taking Bowman Hamel. Our attack was our left flank was Bucourt, that wee village we're looking at. Yep. There's a small disused train station just in front of it. That was one of their main objectives.
Okay.
And on the right, we had the Swaben Redoubt, so straight up on the right edge. Our three regiments, the three principal regiments that made up our division, was the Royal Enniskillen Fusiliers, the Royal Irish Fusiliers, and the Royal Irish Rifles. We had three brigades, 107, 108, and 109 Brigade. 107 Brigade were in reserve, so when the battle started, they would have filtered through and come out behind 108 Brigade, who were on the left, and 109 Brigade on the right. So that was the positions of the three brigades as they come out of the wood. Okay, so that's the friendly forces.
Yeah.
We'll now take a walk over to the Victoria Crossstone, and we'll get into the battle then. We'll start the battle with you, and then we'll talk about Victoria Crosses before we move down the road. Okay.
So we're looking at a stone that's made out of, what's it made out
of? This is made out of Mourne granite, and this was commissioned by the Royal Irish Rangers back in about 1989. I was actually serving and paid some money towards it, although I had never been here.
No.
Or Sandy Nine, I'd never been here before. So I know I paid money towards it. So there was four VCs won in this sector by our division on the first day of the battle for them. And I'm going to give you a piece of information about all four of them.
Right.
But before I do that, I want to start the battle with you.
Yeah.
Because as we move down, I want to explain what happened here. And then as we move down to the centre, we'll talk about our division and the 32nd division. To give you an idea, so you can look and say, right, that happened there and they were there, that sort of thing. So, 7:30, 1st of July, the signified to start the battle was a massive mine crater to go off in an area called Hawthorne Ridge, just beyond Bowman Tommel. You've been up the sunken lane. So that was supposed to be set off at 7:30 in the morning. This battle was due to start originally on the 29th of June. However, because of inclement weather, they cancelled it till the 1st. The commander of the 29th Division, for some reason, set it off 10 minutes early. So the Germans then had an idea something was going to happen that day, something was imminent. That said and done, as you mentioned up the back there, for about 5 days leading into this battle, we had pelted the whole German front line of the Somme, which is about 18 or 19 miles in length, with heavy artillery. Five or six days, morning, noon and night. And as far as our commanders were concerned, we'd killed all the Germans in that area. And the soldiers, in fact, were ordered, when you come out of the trenches, light your pipe and walk onto the objective, they'll all be dead. How wrong were they? If you look round the ground, you'll see it's soft, it's swampy all across the front. And what happened was a lot of them shells were hard, high impact shells. So there was nothing for them to explode. So they all just, most of them just buried themselves into the ground here and landed. And that is why 100-odd years later, day on daily, shells are turning up. When a farmer goes into that field with his tractor, I can guarantee you there'll be shells brought in. I have definitely one grenade out the back that somebody gave me a couple of months back. And people would throw them over our fence. Because, they know we can ring the French bomb disposal.
They're throwing live hand grenades.
Last May, in May past, I had two Stokes mortars, about eight shells, about 20 Mills bombs, lying right at the very, very back fence.
Please, if you're listening, do not do this.
Yeah. I say to people, if you're walking these fields and you see a shell or a grenade, it hasn't went off. Please don't touch it, because it's over 100 years old. It could be volatile.
It's more dangerous now than it was then.
Absolutely. So, and people are picking them up. A tour guide gave me one in these grounds last year and says I found that out in the field. Yeah.
A tour guide.
No names, no mention. He was from back home though.
Right.
And he should have known better. I had his group in the woods and he walked that feeling after. He says, that fourth tree there, he says, I've left a wee present. And that's a grenade that's lying out the back there. I had to put it out the back.
Word.
So please don't. Always advise people not to touch them.
Yeah.
So the battle starts 7:30. The 29th Division start going up towards Bowman Hamill to take their objective. They very, very quickly were halted in their tracks by heavy machine gun fire from the high ground at Bowman Hamill. So that attack came an abrupt halt straight away. We had two battalions that weren't in Thiefaw Wood. They were on the other side of the river, and they were dug in and around a small village you see there called Hamill. And the reason them two battalions were over there was because the commanders had decided not to fight up the valley here, the valley of Saint-Pierre-de-Vion. The River Ancre goes up there, it widens and it narrows, it's very swampy, it's very steep, and the Germans had heavily fortified it the whole way up. Right. So what they decided to do, we'll put two battalions in Hamill, and they will fight up the left edge of the valley, through where the cemetery is, and the whole way up to take Beaucourt Station, and that was their objective that day. Them two battalions were the 12th Royal Irish Rifles and the 9th Royal Irish Fusiliers. And that would start me nicely into the first two VCs that were won on that side of the river the first day of the battle. Right. So, the two battalions come out at the same time as the 29th started their attack and halted. They were literally cut to pieces by heavy machine guns from Beaucourt. And the Germans had also captured Belgian machine guns in that area. So they rained down the valley. And the two battalions attempted about six times to try and reach their objective, and there was very few of them left. So there was two VCs won in that action that day and the next day. And the first one I'm going to talk about is Rifleman Robert Quigg, VC, 12th Battalion of the Royal Irish Rifles. He was born and bred in a little village in County Antrim called Bush Mills. Which were Bush Mills Whiskies born. So Robert Quigg. He went out into the battlefield, he took supplies out, medical supplies, water, and he was recovering casualties back in. On the 2nd of July, he was on his way back in with a casualty when he noticed a young fella lying, so he went back in and then got some supplies to go out and recover this young fella, and sadly he was mortally wounded there, and he lost his life. And for that he was obviously awarded the VC.
Does he have a grave?
No.
So he's over behind us on the teak
family. The third one, which was won on this side, mm-hmm. and it was won prior to the battle mm-hmm. starting, is Rifleman William McFadgen.
You mentioned him before we came.
Battalion.
This is my favourite VC story of all.
Right.
This one.
VC. Yeah. So William McFadgen was born and bred in a wee place called Lurgan.
I know Lurgan.
Wouldn't be far across the hill from where you are. But he worked in the textile trade. He seemed to be very good at what he'd done. He was only a young fella, and his work brought him to Belfast. His employment brought him to Belfast, and he worked for a company called Spencer Bryson. I think they were a linen company somewhere in the centre of the town. But he lived in a wee housing estate on the east end of the city called the Craiga Estate. Now, the Craiga Estate in itself is famous because that's where the famous footballer George Best was born and bred. Burham Way, 16 Burham Way, is where George Best was born. So, famous in the First World War and later.
Now, Willie McFadgen was in the 14th Battalion, and they were part of 109 Brigade on the right. His job in the battalion, he was, would have been known as a grenadier or a bomber. Now, that made him qualified to lob and throw grenades in the battlefield. Not all soldiers could do this. You had to be trained, you had to do a course and be trained. And they used people like cricketers, guys who bowl and maybe basketball players. And
so none of your lot in Australia would be able to do this.
No. And they'd had to kick the grenades. You know, so he was qualified at doing that. And his job, obviously, was to issue grenades out. Now, all the soldiers would have carried grenades in the battle. But what they'd done then, they'd have passed them left and right on the battlefield to the grenadier who would have lobbed them. It's different now in the British Army. You do an hour's training and you go and throw them. Right. Simple. So William McFadgen's job, prior to 7:30 in the morning, he's in Thiefa Wood at the parapet of a trench. He opens up a box of grenades as the soldiers are filtering through to issue them out. Right. And as he opened the box, a load of them fell into the trench. And when he looked down, he saw pins dislodging. So he knew they were going to go off.
Awesome.
So he jumped straight in top of it and threw himself on top of the grenades. Blew himself to pieces, obviously. And there was only one serious injury in the whole system, the whole trench system. Yeah. And that was one young lad lost his leg. Young fella called Gillespie. He lost a leg. He saved everybody's lives.
And that's before the battle started.
Before the battle started. And he obviously is on the memorial to the missing. Mm-hmm. There are many, many myths about William McFadgen. He's very, very famous among people back home. Mm-hmm. The Somme Associations and the Ulster Volunteer Force. And they sort of have, he's their hero. Mm-hmm. And there's many, many stories about they think, or people think, where he is in this wood. We're led to believe that he is in Connacht Cemetery. His remains were buried in Connacht Cemetery somewhere. Okay. He has a great nephew, Nigel, who comes here, stays with Julie.
Okay.
Julie will tell you the story. They know him very well.
Yeah.
And he comes quite regular, and you know he says the same thing. They think he's buried in that cemetery. Okay. Others will have you believe he's in the woods somewhere. But
they don't know, do they? You've got no evidence. But wasn't he just 18?
He's about 18, yeah.
And he's got, when he sees those pins, I think when I go into schools, I say to the kids, what would you do? You've got 4 seconds. I would run away, I'll do that. All this.
Yeah.
Well, by the time you've explained that to me, the grenade's gone off.
Gone.
One, two, three.
Yeah.
Four.
That's right.
He jumped on top of them.
Yeah. He done that, instinctively. Must have done that very, very quickly. Yeah. When you consider there was a load of grenades falling in, and he'd be seeing pins, just no thought at all, just straight
in. Dived on them. That's why it's my
absolutely.
Favorite. Like, talk about selfless and
I know.
Giving your life to save others.
4 seconds.
Yeah. 4 seconds, yep. Fourth, last and not least, Captain Eric Bell, VC, 9th Battalion, the Royal Enniskillen Fusiliers. Again, part of 109 Brigade on the right. He was a trench mortar commander, so when they come out of the wood, his job was to bring the machine guns and the mortars forward. But when they come out of the wood, heavy machine gun fire from the Swabian redoubt pinned them down and they had to go to ground. They couldn't move. So Captain Bell crawled forward to the machine gun post and he threw 2 mortars. Not grenades, mortars, into the trench and killed the machine gunners. He then stood up with his rifle and emptied his magazine into German trenches. Quite a lot of the officers have been killed very early. So on his way back to get the soldiers ready to move, he started organising the troops ready to start doing the waves of attack. And when he was doing that, he was sadly killed himself. He was shot and killed.
Right.
So that's Captain Eric Bell. Wow. And that's the 4 that were won on the first day of this battle.
Yeah.
Not a bad start to a battle, is
no,
it?
No.
Although they haven't made much progress, as we'll find out.
Guys, we're going to walk down the road now to the centre and then we'll talk about our division, what they've done here. And we'll also let you have a look at the ground and tell you what the 32nd Division were up to. Before we do that, I'd just like to talk about this road.
Yes.
This is the D73. And it runs, obviously, from the crossroads at Thiefval down to St Pierre de Ville. Now, back in 1916, this was called the Sunken Road. Now, you've been to the Sunken Lane. There's quite a few sunken roads around the country. But there was a bank either side of this road about 2.5 metres high the whole way. If you come from the top end, you can see it when you turn the corner and then it disappears. And also, just as you go around that bend, it comes up again. Yes. But it was all like that. The road was raised in 1919 for the construction of the cemetery, Connacht Cemetery. And all the stone and the stuff that was brought up from it was brought from a Tweel village. There was a wee quarry there. And they brought all the stuff up in a by horse and cart and they brought the road up to the level for it to be done. The road featured again in 2013. when it was being widened. So the lovely cobblestones, you see, weren't there before 13.
Okay.
So they dug up the whole side of the road to widen it, yep, in preparation for the 100th anniversary of the Battle of the Somme. While the road was dug up, the remains of three soldiers were found on this road.
Right. Wow.
And the first one was found, you see the blue sign?
Yeah.
Just to the right on the grass, there was a spoil heap there. And the remains of one soldier was found there. Now, unidentifiable, nothing on him to tell who he was. However, when they took the remains away, there was a tour guide, I think from Ledger Tours, I think Tim told me this last year, who was in the area, and a tractor and a trailer took the spoil away to dump it. He followed it, and when it was dumped, he went through it, and he found the shoulder title of a soldier in the Cambridgeshire Regiment.
Oh.
So
they were here in October.
That's how we found out. He's buried in that cemetery, a soldier known to God, yeah, the Cambridgeshire Regiment. So that's how he was identified.
So they've taken part of the redoubt right at the end, haven't they?
Yes, they did, yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
Then we had one, if you look at the border of our memorial, you'll see a grey box just outside it.
Yep. Yep.
The second remains was found there. Okay. All we found there was a Royal Irish Rifles cap badge. Okay. So we think he could have been, when we looked at about this side, he could have been the 13th Royal Irish Southampton for Lisburn, taken in part of Lisburn as well. But that was the only identification. The third and final one was found just as you turn right, as we're going to walk past it, at the end of the cemetery, as you go right to go into the cemetery. And he was found by the guy doing my job, a fella called Don Mitchell, who was working here at the time. Okay. Went down to Thiefel Wood and he found the remains. But on this soldier we found an identity bracelet.
Right.
So we were able to find out who he was.
Found
he was an Englishman. His name was Sergeant David Harkness Blakey. And he was born and bred in a wee village in the north of England called Felham, in Gateshead and Tynemuir. So that's where he was born. Apparently, he answered an advert in the Newcastle Chronicle to join an Irish regiment, which he did. He went to Finner Camp in Donegal to do his basic training with the Enniskillens. And while he was there, he met, fell in love, and married a young girl, as to do. She's believed to be from the Bogside in Derry. And they had a son, and the son was called Henry. Henry followed his father into the army in the Second World War, and sadly was killed in June 1940 at Dunkirk.
Oh.
So the father died here, and young Henry died in the Second World War. So
two wars overlap again,
yeah,
isn't it?
Now, David Blakey was already a military medal recipient before he came here, so he'd obviously took action, he saw action somewhere else. Now, all three of them soldiers were buried with full military honours by the 1st Battalion of the Royal Irish Regiment, my regiment, and they all rest in that cemetery. I'll show you the headstones as we go down. We did find, we made contact with one of Blakey's family, and his great-great-niece attended the funeral, but the family have been back since, which is really, really
That's
good.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, we're
100 years.
We're talking 2013, and there's just under 73,000 names in that memorial. How many other soldiers are lying in these grounds?
Yeah. They must have found more, those contractors.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's another story.
It is, yeah.
Wow.
Okay, guys, so we'll make our way down now. At that same time, obviously, the 32nd Division came in from way round the corner, a place called Avloy and beyond, and they really attack up the open ground you see there to take Thiefel Village. Now, Thiefel Village, quite high up, was heavily fortified by German machine guns, and that attack, there were seven cuts in the wire all along the open ground. And as the soldiers went to the cuts in the wire, they were mown down by machine gun. That attack also came to an abrupt halt. And it is said that soldiers were strewn across the barbed wire all across the open ground. While this was happening, the Ultra Division had come out of Thiefel Wood. They had taken the German front line where the cemetery is. They'd taken the German second line. And they'd taken the Schwaben Redoubt. And it is said that there was heavy hand-to-hand fighting between Ulstermen and German soldiers at the Schwaben Redoubt.
Did they walk across no man's land here?
I'll give you that in a wee sec.
Okay.
In fact, when the 49th Division came through, 3 or 4 days later, when they got to the Schwaben Redoubt, they said they seen dead Ulster soldiers lying in a trench alongside Germans. But not only did they take the Schwaben Redoubt, they took the 4th line and pockets of them got to the 5th line.
Wow.
Now, so you look at it, they're nearly a mile that way. Because these two attacks had stopped, the machine guns on either side were able to switch fire.
Yeah.
So the division ended up in a salient up there. They couldn't sustain that.
Yeah.
There was a creeping barrage, which had been stopped by the command, because some commander over here had sent us a message back to say they were in the village, his soldiers were in the village. There was a couple of soldiers did get to the village apparently, but not much. So quite understandably, the ultra division answered that the artillery division were refused. Quite rightly, because if the command thought that British soldiers were in, they followed and killed their own soldiers. But they couldn't sustain this, so they're in this salient being fired on from the right, the left, and the front. What they had to then do is make a decision to do a tactical withdrawal. And as I say to people, the British, it's a tactical withdrawal.
Yes, of course.
So they made their way back and consolidated on the German front line, which is right along where the cemetery is. Very, very shortly after that, the Germans put in a counterattack. By early evening, on the 1st of July, they were back in Thiefall Wood in their trenches. All that in one day, about just over 5,000 injuries, of which 2,009 or 19 was killed, just in this one action that day. Now, I said they were in Thiefall Wood at 7:30 on the 1st of July, the division. They weren't. I lied.
Okay. No, we weren't.
Do you remember I said to you this was a sunken road and there was banks?
Well, they had
come out of the wood in the dead of night, and they were standing where we're standing now, up this side of the bank. I'm going to show you how they got out when we go in there, how they're lined up here. But this is where they started the attack. And to take your point, Terry, did they walk onto the objective? The order was, remember I said, light your pipe and walk onto the objective. That was very common. Walking onto the battlefield was very common because people fell in the shell holes. So that order was to walk. Now, people have asked me, how did the Ulster Division get so far when things left and right didn't happen? There's no the only advantage I can see that they had was about 50 metres from there to here.
Uh-huh.
So they were already out here. General Nugent, our commander, I think he was a very, very shrewd tactician. Now, there's a number of things I think might have happened, and one of them would have been he didn't tell his soldiers to walk.
Uh-huh.
He said, you get there as quick as you can. That would be one.
Yeah.
And another thing which is quite common in the British Army, if you're going to do an attack like this, each soldier in this battle was ordered to carry 3 days' kit. So the 3 days' ammo, water, rations on them. So heavy laden down. I think General Nugent told them to drop their heavy packs. And what we call in the Army now, fight light. So you'd come to a situation, I guess, you'd drop your heavy packs, you'd go and do the attack, consolidate there, and they would bring the stuff up.
Right.
Up to you,
right.
And then you'd move on. That's a tactic in the British Army. I don't know why that happened or not. It's sheer madness how they've done it, and bravery how they got so far so quick.
They wouldn't have been able to run with 60 pounds.
No way. Now, you just look at that
now.
I can't imagine this, full of barbed wire, full of shell holes, artillery flying, machine guns flying left and right. And when you look on the right, look at the hill the 32nd Division had to go up. And the 29th on the left.
Just
beggar's belief.
Yeah.
If you can imagine that.
So we're now wandering through the Connaught Cemetery. There's so many of these lads that advanced from these woods that we're just about to go into, and now at rest. Beautiful cemetery in the shadow of a Teepvale wood. We now come to the wood itself, which is surrounded by a green fence. It's private property, it's owned by the Somme Association, and therefore
so
you can't go in the village,
guys,
can't go in the wood without an appointment. And the gate is locked.
This gate is
we'll catch up with Rocky.
And again, he paid for it, got it done, lasered, and he brought it out in his wee camper van. He put a roof rack and he erected it himself in September there past. Now, there's a wee bit of significance here in this topic, and some of it can be a bit controversial back home.
Okay.
And I'll tell you when I'll be sack. So, the significance of all the things you see, the first thing you look at is the soldiers left and right. And they signify Thiefall Wood being guarded by the soldiers of the 36th Ulster Division.
Uh-huh.
The crosses you see, there's 16 of them. And they are in remembrance of respect for the 16th Irish Division from the south of Ireland, who fought about 13 or 14 mile in a place called Gielemont and Ginshi.
Uh-huh.
Now, you're well aware of what was going on in Ireland at that time. So these were arch enemies who were going to go to war, civil war with each other prior to this battle. They didn't actually fight together here, but they did fight twice together in Belgium, once at the Battle of Messines Ridge and the Battle of Langemarck.
Uh-huh.
And the leader of the Irish National Party was a fellow called Willie Redmond, him and his brother John Redmond. But Willie Redmond was injured on the first day of Messines, and he was carried off the battlefield by an Ulster soldier.
Right.
Now, while that Ulster soldier was carrying him, he got shot.
Right.
And died.
The Ulster soldier.
Yeah. And another Ulster soldier picked Willie Redmond up and carried him to safety. you know, big significance of people, arch enemies who hated each other.
Across the divide, aren't they?
Right across from it, back in them days, you know, so it's very fitting. And sadly, Willie Redmond died later on of his injuries that day. He passed away that day. But the, so that's the 16th Irish in remembrance of them. They didn't fight in this wood, they were never in this wood. And people have asked, why are we talking about them?
For that reason.
They were one of our divisions that formed our divisions that fought, you know. All right, they weren't in here, and we understand that. But that's the reason for it. Yep. Then we have the poppies with the leaf at 11 o'clock. 36 of them. Oh, so they signify the Ulster Division. 36 Ulster Division. So I think it's a beautiful piece of
it work.
And very, very fitting to it. It's better than a bit of barbed wire.
Yeah, definitely. Nice
Okay. Now, last week, while we were here, or while the boys were over,
we've got a wooden cross with some ceramic red poppies on it as well on the gate.
I'll give you the story about the wood in a wee second, but we come out here twice a year and we work in the trenches. Okay. Started off excavating and doing all the stuff, but I'll give you that story. But last week the guys were out doing a bit of a tidy up and clearing the place out. And we're going to take you actually into a trench system now, which is brand new.
It's a new experience.
This was only added last week.
Is that right?
So yeah, it's a short walk, but it just gives you the idea in the room.
Lucky.
And then we'll come back out again, and then we'll give you the story of the trenches.
Yeah, fantastic.
So who are these guys who come over to do
that? They're all like myself, volunteers. We've been doing it for years. All ex, but they're all ex now. Yeah.
So what Rocky has explained there is that for many years we've been coming to the trench experience here, but they've made one of the trenches now accessible for visitors. It was just last week that they opened up this short stretch of trench. So what we're going to do now, the four of us, we're going to walk actually through an excavated original First World War trench that those 36 Ulster Division formed up in, crawled out to no man's land, assembled in Mill Road, what's now called Mill Road.
Just abandoned it because we haven't got enough manpower to do it. The guy's done this week.
So the trench.
Particularly for kids and people who can have a wee look.
The
trench has got sandbags on the top, as they would have been, and it's been reinforced with iron posts and steel. And then we move on to the next section. We've now got another piece of trench, which again has been reinforced. Three lines of sandbags on the top, got duck boards in the bottom, and it's got the fire step and a sap as well. So Rocky will take up the story.
This wood, Thiefall wood, was purchased by the Somme Association. We got financial backing from the Department of Art, Culture and Leisure back home in Northern Ireland, and we purchased this wood. So this wood belongs to the Somme Association. When it was purchased in 2004, we set about a project of opening up some original trenches in the wood for educational purposes and to do guided tours like we're doing today. The aim back in that day, and it still is the same aim today, is to keep these trenches as authentic as humanly possible, using the equipment that the soldiers would have had available to them back in that day. And everything you see, probably bar the large 6-foot pickets, they wouldn't have really had them. They did have pickets back in them days, but not in that sort of form. But the sandbags, the Wrigley tin, the wire, everything you see, the soldier would have had available to him to dig these trenches and to work in these trenches. And that is the aim. And I don't think you'll go anywhere where you'll see trenches as authentic as these. We got together with a group of archaeologists, part-time archaeologists from England called No Man's Land. And a group of volunteers in the Royal Irish Regiment, soldiers like myself, and we come out and we done the work. So they planned the trench, then we went in and we done all the hard work. They went in and found any of the stuff that they find, as they do. But we had soldiers in here, we brought no machinery in. It was shovels, picks, and guys were standing here with ropes and buckets, like me. And we were taking the spoil away, digging the trench out to each stage, and then most of the spoil we had to bring back again to build into the walls. But if you look just below the front layer, you'll see it's all rock. Very, very hard going ground, really, really is. Now, the wood itself is about roughly about a mile squared in size. And within that square mile, there is approximately 55 kilometres of trench system in this wood, in the one wood. All the trenches originally were dug and built by the French army. However, on the 31st of July 1915, the 51st Highland Division moved in here and took over from the French. And there was an official handover at a wee central part of the wood called the Atuil. And the 51st Highlanders moved in. Apparently the trenches were in a terrible state. The French hadn't really done a lot of work to them. And I'm sure there was a bit of argument going on. But the old jocks being the jocks, they came and sorted them all out and dug them all properly and got them all in good order. Now, while they were doing that, back in the end days, nobody walked. All these beautiful trees weren't here. Nobody walked above the ground. Obviously, the enemy's just there. So the movement was by what they call a communication trench. And that's what most of these are. These go right in the back of the wood. And as you walk round, you'll see the undulating ground. They're all trenches. All of them are trenches. So the soldier would have come up through the communication trenches, which were built thin and deep. They're only for movement. And they were also built in zigzags. That was part of the building. And the reason for that was to save them from shelling. And also, you never know who's round the corner. So that's another a big reason why they were done in zigzags. So the soldier would have came from the back end of the wood where the admin area was, with three brigade headquarters, would have come up here. The soldiers would have come up here and done a four-day tour of duty prior to the battle. So the way they got here, they would have come through the communication trenches. They came in one way and they left the other way. Nobody ever crossed. That you had to keep command and control. That would have caused an awful lot of nightmares. And the British Army to this day do the same thing. They call it a track plan. Okay. So when you go into a harbour or hide in a wood, every soldier is briefed on how they move about that wood, and they all move the same way. Right. Still to this day they do that. So they would have done 4 days here, a tour of duty. They had 100 rounds of ammunition, all their equipment, and they would have spent the days in here fixing and mending any of the trenches that had been damaged. They would have done sentry, particularly for gas, because we were using gas back then. So they would have been an early warning to the rest of the division at the rear of the wood, early warning for gas. And then they would have been down on patrols, particularly in the evening, to try and get prisoners of war for information, particularly officers. So those are the sort of duties they would have done while they were in the 4 days here. Then they moved back to the wood, probably continued their training, continued with fatigues and anything else they needed to do. And the rear area where the soldiers rested was a place called Magenta. That was the name of the area where they rested. So this is one section of the front line trench. This trench runs from the extreme edge of the wood this way, the whole way along, and down to the banks of the River Ancre. This is just one section of it. You see here a step higher up. This is what's called a fire step. Now, when this trench was dug out, there was very, very little evidence of ammunition of firing in this trench. They didn't find many rounds of ammunition, empty cases, which they really should have, particularly when we found lots of stuff in the other ones. So the conclusion was then brought that they maybe used this trench for observation. Now, this is where 109 Brigade would be. Now, 109 Brigade's objective was to swab and read out. If I stand here and point in that direction, you would walk onto the swab and read out roughly there in that area, the third line. So we think that's probably what this was used for, this section of it, which makes a lot of sense. Makes sense. Now, have you any idea what this is? Good man. This is what's called a sap trench. You heard the old saying, the Royal Engineers, sappers. This is a sap trench. So that would have went the whole way out onto the sunken road. There's 9 of these all along the front line, and this is sap number 1. Okay. Sap number 2, I'm going to show you where it was. It's not actually dug out. But from sap number 2 on, they all had names. The next sap we'll talk about will be Thinner Sap, which is named after our training camp in Donegal, where the skins were. So sap number 1. So the soldiers would have come through the communication trenches in the dead of night into the front line trenches, and then they would have peeled off the whole way and walked out onto the road to line up ready to do the attack the next day.
So some of those men that we've been talking about would have literally come through this sap here.
Yes, absolutely, 109. Yep.
On that morning.
Yep, and filtered out. This was the first sap.
That feels incredible, doesn't it?
You would think that they're going to come through here and just walk
single file, it's very thin, very narrow.
Yep.
And even then, when you come out of the excavated trenches and the rest of the wood, you can just about make out the zigzag line.
All this ground you're looking at all here.
Zigzag line of the trench line that hasn't been excavated, but you can still see it, just the shallow marks in the ground. You can see the shell holes. You can hear the birds singing. I don't know whether you can pick that up on the microphone. Of course, as Rocky said, these trees would not have been here in July 1916, wood, name only. I think this is really interesting as well, because when I first came here, this had been dug out and it was all neat and tidy.
Yeah, that's right.
And that just shows what happens with the trenches when they're neglected and left. And this is what would have happened, the condition that this trench is in is what would have happened for all of the trenches on the Western Front if they hadn't been backfilled.
You know, we come out twice a year and the sandbags and all that work, it really needs done twice a year.
Rots away, doesn't
it? Still, you know, you'll see evidence of sandbags that need replaced when we go around.
Is there sand in them or mud?
It's all sand. We've struggled with different things over the year to try and give them a longer life. We use clear plastic bags, thick plastic bags inside the sandbag and then the sand in it. But we've used sprays, we've used Creole spray and different things to try and preserve the sandbag.
But originally they'd have just used whatever they could to put in them, wouldn't they?
It would have been new dirt. We get the sand delivered, so they wouldn't have had it delivered from Alberta. It would have been whatever they could get their hands on. And all the equipment you see, all the sandbags, the materials, were all donated by the British Army to enable us to do this project. Now, the British Army don't know they donated it.
No, I might leave that bit out of the podcast.
That's all right. It's well documented. They don't know they donated it, but they did. So when people like me was in charge of the stores, we would have ordered 200 sandbags for the store and 100 to France.
Yeah.
But now there's only one of us left, so he's going to struggle to get the kit.
So in time.
We have a good supply, actually.
You've thought ahead, haven't you?
Yeah.
Plans. So peaceful here now, isn't it? So peaceful in the wood.
It's still a working wood. We employ a woodkeeper, and there's pheasants, there's deer.
There's hunting going on?
Pardon?
Hunting going on?
There was a hunt two Sundays ago. Wild boar, a lot of wild boar in here.
We chased it
a few times over the years. But beautiful deer. There's two young baby deer on that field outside facing the car last week on Thursday. All day. They didn't move. They were just eating grass the whole day. Nobody disturbed them.
Yeah.
Wow. And I couldn't get it. Zoom the camera in far enough.
Yeah.
But they stayed out there all day.
Wow.
And I walked down there last year, and just as I walked down the centre path, a wee family just run straight past me.
Oh, really?
Straight across where
they all stopped and said, "Look, there's Rocky."
Oh, it's Rocky.
I'd believe a word.
It's still dangerous, isn't it?
And loads of stuff.
And bodies will be here because it's not been cleared, has it, these woods? They're still.
Absolutely.
Men that would have been killed moving up from shell fire. Not just in June 1916, but
beyond.
Going forward.
And this battle went on to November, 141 days. Okay, so this is an extension of the trench we've just been on, frontline trench. However, this section is known as a cut and cover trench. So the trench was dug out. There's two bunkers here, and they were cut out and covered. So that's where you get the cut and cover. Cut the bunker out and cover it with a roof. Now it caved in quite a few years ago. It started the bellow. It started to do it again. So we had to dig it all out. One of the tour guides fell until it nearly disappeared. If it had been me, you'd never found me. I'm that small. But so we dug it all back, took the roof off it, and then we brought some welding gear in and put proper struts in, and then put the roof back on. But if I do this, if you look at the ground.
Moving. I can feel it moving under my feet.
Feel it. You know, I'm not sure I'll stand here in 2 years and do this.
No.
And I was here when it was done, so. But anyway.
When
did you do that? What year was it reinforced? It was only about 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay. I've never experienced anything like that. It felt like an earthquake under my feet.
All it is wrigley tin. Wrigley tin and spoil. That's all it is. With obviously metal frames, uprights.
But it's still gracious.
So, we have two bunkers here. When this was dug out in about 2006, they found stuff in here. In fact, this one was started, that was 2004, the first one. I think this was the second one done by 2005, maybe the end of 4. They found some stuff in here in both these bunkers that tells us who occupied it, gives us information of who occupied it. Now, the one on the right, we know was occupied by the French army, because we found loads and loads and loads of wine bottles, empty wine bottles.
Is that right?
Now, they're all up in the museum.
Okay.
Yeah, if you go into the glass case, there's a glass case full of wine bottles.
From here?
There. We also found in there in the case as well. French army tunic buttons of their uniform, so we found that in there. Plus the French is 5-star accommodation. This is they had a burner, a fire, a cooker to cook in here. And don't quote me. I'm led to believe they had Wi-Fi and Sky TV, but I don't know how true that is. So that's sort of the French side. And this bunker here was very different. We found a soldier's backpack. We found an ammunition, Huntley and Palmer hardtack biscuits. And a wee small book called, I can't remember the proper, The Exploits of Dr. Fu Manchu or something. Now that's up in the case as well, what's left of it. It's only a wee small thing. And there, in addition to that, we found a wobbling brush, a shaving stick, and a bar of soap.
Right.
You remember them back in the day?
Yeah.
So we found that in there. But on the soap, it had an inscribed. It was inscribed Finlay's of Belfast.
Really?
So we now know Ulster soldier in here at some stage. Whether he had been brought in injured and left that kit as he moved back, or he lost it, we don't know. But Finlay's of Belfast is in a place called Victoria Square, just past the City Hall. There's a massive shopping centre there now, cinemas and all that sort of stuff. But back in the day, our division marched past Belfast City Hall and done the old salute, going to war. And as they marched past the City Hall and they got to Victoria Square, the staff of Finlay's of Belfast give every soldier a wobbling brush, a shaving stick and a wee bar.
How about that? And then it ends up here and you find it.
100-odd years later we find it here. Wow. Now the soap's gone, I think some of the volunteers used it. But the wee wobbling brush and the stick and the wee book is all in a case up there
that
was found. So that's the story in this one. Now we did speak about the sap trenches. There's a sap here called Thinner Sap, sap number 2. And it sort of comes round past the base of that tree, out through where the cemetery is, and out onto the road. Now in this area, in about 2006, the boys were digging here. And back in them days, when we dug, if we found anything, munitions of any description, everything stopped and we evacuated the wood. In addition to the archaeologist, we had a British Army bomb disposal guy with us. And anything that was found, he took care of it. He would have took it to one side, taped it off, centralised it all. We then phoned the French bomb disposals. I call them the bomb disposables. And they would have come out. Now, they would have trundled in here in a wee van. And he would have had maybe shells, grenades, lander, cigarette in the mouth, hat in the back of the head, and just pick it all up and fire it in the back of the van and drive out.
So highly trained then.
Highly trained.
We were very worried.
I have seen that. Why, we're all standing out there, making sure we're all alive still. Unbelievable. And I've seen it. It does happen. Still probably to this day. I think it's about 5 years and I've seen them. Anyway, but one of the soldiers was digging in here one day and he clunked metal down below. So everything stopped. Everybody left the wood. And the old AOD guy, we call him AOD Eric, he came in, and after about 7 hours, they pulled out 4 canisters, and 2 of them were completely full of phosgene chlorine gas.
Oh, blimey.
Fully charged, 2 ampy, 2 full.
That's not what you want, really, is it?
No. On the 20, I think it was about the 26th of June, they brought in these canisters to gas the Germans, and what they'd done, they put them in the sap, pointed them in that direction, and turned them on. However, the wind changed, and there was 13 soldiers killed in this frontier. Yeah. Now, you've probably walked past their graves, because they're all buried in the Tweel Cemetery. So you probably walked past...
In Tweel?
And they're in a Tweel Cemetery. We don't know who they are.
No.
It doesn't say they were gas.
Where we were last night.
But where you were, they're all buried in that cemetery, and that happened through that gas. Called out the old bomb disposal guys. They trundling in the van. This time they weren't smoking. You only had the hat in the back of the head.
Really,
we had the canisters over there, the cylinders, and they put through them in the back of the van and drove away. And the story is, from Terry Colligan tells me this, I think he's bluffing with me. The story is, they drove down the road, pulled in at the bottom of the valley, and threw the gas canisters into the river and drove on. Now, I don't know how true that is, but I say to people, don't paddle your feet down there, and certainly don't try and catch any fish.
But don't drink out of it.
How big were the canisters?
They were about yay high.
Really?
Big grey ones, yeah.
Gosh, what a horrific weapon.
Unbelievable. I mean, we were out. We were out basically arrested that day, but it took the guys about 7 hours to get it out, to get them out, to recover them.
And you don't know where they're going to leak, do you?
No,
you know what condition
and nothing was said. None of the locals were told anything about it. Couldn't really say
if the wind would have blown.
So dangerous, like,
yeah,
you know, 100-odd years old,
yeah,
full. And it's the school kids. I say to the kids, do you know what chlorine phosgene chlorine is, and they go, it's a death. Death.
Drowning.
Yep.
Drown from within.
Within, you know, unbelievable. Guys, we're going to go to the next trench here, which is just down that middle path and to the left.
Just as we leave this section, by the gate, there's a piece of coil of rusted barbed wire. Another reminder of where we are. Rocky's off, got to catch him up. So we've got a hole in the ground.
And basically, it's the story of the Thiefar Wood ammunition dump. So it's and it's information. There's a couple of paragraphs from the London Times Paris correspondent talking about this. This actually exploded.
So it's not a mine crater.
On the 7th of March,
right?
1921.
1921.
21. So it was an ammunition dump. Now there was a couple of theories of how it went off. One theory was that somebody disturbed it, and it blew up. That would probably be accurate. Because back in the end days, it was very common for local people to find all these shells and try and take the precious metal off them. So that's one theory that happened. It was disturbed. However, nobody was ever reported missing, and they didn't find any body parts. The other theory was that the French government had employed people to go around all these battle sites and tape off or mark off the areas so that they could be cleared to let agriculture work and stuff go on, to get them cleared and make them safe. And the other theory is that somebody disturbed it by finding a run of wire into the ground. They thought it was communication wire or something, pulled it. But when it went off, it blew the whole coping wall off the back of the cemetery, every part of it. And it damaged about 70 headstones.
That's some force behind it, didn't it? Yeah.
Now, Fabian Moore, you know, General Fabian Moore, he had a general out here doing an inspection or a visit around the graveyards in this area, and when it went off, he sent them here to do an estimate for the cost. I can't remember exactly the cost, but when you go up it, it'll show you. But the men, the coping stones, I think it was about £300. One was in francs, 300 odd francs or something, and the other one was a few hundred pounds for 70 headstones to be mended.
That's a lot of money then.
Absolutely. You know, it's equivalent now. Yeah. Them headstones will probably cost, I don't know.
I'll tell you what I'm thinking now. How many more ammunition dumps are there here that we don't know about?
Belgium. There's mine craters in Belgium that have never been dug out. Still live mine craters. Mm. You're right, you don't know.
Mm, you don't know.
You don't know.
No, so tread carefully.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I always say that people would be very careful. So there you are, 7th of March, not 1916. We're now going to go and talk about another big hole now. This is more interesting.
Is this where you fell over?
No. I'm keeping the best to last. We've showed you Frontline Trench, and obviously Frontline Trench goes left to right. Communication trenches back to front, and we also have 9 mortar pits here, which I'm going to show you one next, the last trench. But this is obviously a communication trench going from the rear to the front. It also would have been used as an assembly trench because it's so near the front line to the soldiers. And the picture is at 7:30, 108 Brigade out on the left, 109 on the right, and 107 Brigade, which consisted of all the Belfast battalions, would have filtered through here and filtered out onto the battlefield left and right and followed suit. Now, there was an artifact found in here in 2011 by an archaeologist, and I'm going to show you. You'll know what it is.
Very famous.
Any idea? That's what's called a button stick. Okay. This was issued to British soldiers. So basically, you put it up, run it through your buttons, so you could polish your buttons and not get brasso on your jacket. Yeah. All the soldiers were issued with that. Now, I asked you the question. You're standing here, maybe 3 foot of mud, rats, lice. You're about to walk out there and probably get blue to bits. Would you be worried about doing your buttons?
You would think not.
No. However, it was issued to the soldier when they joined the army, and they would have used it prior to battle or in peacetime. Now, I call that a tool of discipline. I don't call it a button stick, because in the army, when you join the army, the first thing you get instilled into you is discipline. Now, discipline comes in many forms. It can come in the form of marching up and down a square at 3 o'clock in the morning, by the sergeant major or the sergeant coming in to do a room inspection. It's not good enough, and he throws all your kit out the window. Or more commonly, when I joined in 75, you do something wrong, the sergeant major takes you around the back of the building and hooks one on you. Wouldn't get away with that now. Right. But another part of discipline in the soldier is cleanliness. Now, for a soldier to be effective, to be able to go out and fight, he has to be in good order. So he needs to be taught how to keep himself clean, how to look after his feet, his socks, change his underwear, wash his body, look after his equipment. And that is a big part of discipline, discipline in a soldier. Because if he doesn't do that, when he goes out there, he's going to be ineffective. So that's a big, big part of discipline. It all comes in the one thing. And that, to me, is a tool of discipline. There's information on that button stick. And that information tells us that that belonged to a Sergeant Sam Scott. Sam Scott was in the 9th West Belfast Battalion, the Royal Irish Rifles, where I'm from. He came from West Belfast, where I'm from. Now, Sergeant Scott would have got into a lot of trouble for losing that. Because if a sergeant can't look after his kit, how can he make sure a soldier does? So I think he would have got into a lot of trouble. And he lost that in here.
What happened to him?
I'll tell you at the end.
Ah.
Now, Sam Scott, the 9th West Belfast Battalion, we now know, were in this trench. They come through here as a reserve division or brigade to go out onto the battlefield where he lost that. They had a commanding officer, and the commanding officer was a fellow called Lieutenant Colonel Percival Crozier. Very, very famous soldier back home. You've probably heard of him. He fought in the Boer War. However, at the end of the Boer War, he was dishonorably discharged from the army because he paid for his officer's mess bill with a cheque, and he didn't have the funds in his account, so he bounced the cheque. So they threw him out. However, at the outbreak of the First World War, because he was such a good soldier, he was drafted back in, and he commanded this battalion. In fact, he was very instrumental in training the Ulster Volunteer Force to become soldiers in the 36th Ulster Division. He met a lot of his old NCO sergeants and corporals in Horse Guards parade in London, and he took a pile of them over to Northern Ireland, and they then started training the Ulster Volunteer Force. He asked for permission to command this battalion. I think he was given another battalion of in the 16th. And he asked specifically, and I think Lord Carson got, or Captain Craig got him command of this battalion. Now, he wrote a book, and in that book, he talks about this trench. He talks about that large bunker, which I'll go on to now. If you look down into that, that bunker goes the whole way round the inside of the big tree, right the whole way round here. It is absolutely massive. It goes down about 35 feet. I was in it many years ago. It caved in about 7 or 8 years ago. Here's an entrance to it, and you can see it, Terry.
Yeah.
Beyond that entrance, we have blocked it up, but when you go in there, there's a steep stairway dug under the rock that takes you right down, and it is massive. I would say you could probably get onwards of about 100 soldiers in there. Absolutely massive. So Colonel Crozier talked about this trench, and he talked about that hole. Now, he wrote a book in this book. There's a famous quote. The book's called Brass Hat in No Man's Land. It's a really, really good book. If you're into that, yeah. Obviously you're into the section, the rifles and all that. I have a copy in the museum. I can show you, you can take a picture. If you have a Kindle, you can download it for about 99p. I think somebody got it last year. Okay. But if you buy it, it's about 11 quid. It's a really, really good book. And in that book, he talks, gives a quote about this trench and about what he sees when he's standing there. Where I'm pointing. Now I'm going to read that quote to you. It's not something you talk, you read off your mind. I need to read it to get you to take it in and absorb what his thoughts were. And for that, I need my glasses.
Fair enough.
It's amazing to think that the account we're going to read now takes us back to 1916 on the spot that we're standing here.
So, battle starts. 9th Battalion's coming through here. Colonel Crozier is given permission to use this bunker as his headquarters because it was deep and it would afford him cover from shell fire and everything else while he filtered his soldiers out onto the battlefield. So he arrives here to where I'm pointing, and this is what he said. A wrong thing has been done. I find the place full of dead and wounded men. It has been used as a refuge. None of the wounded can walk. There are no stretchers, and most of them are in agony. They have seen no doctor, and some have been there for days. As I enter the dugout, I am greeted with the most awful cries from these dreadfully wounded men. Their removal is a Herculean task, for it was never intended that the dying and the helpless should have to use a steep stairway. After a while, the last suffer and the last corpses are removed. Meanwhile, I mount the parapet to observe. The attack on the right has come to a standstill, and the last detailed man has sacrificed himself on the German wire to the god of war. Thiefa Wood is masked with corpses, which is an answer to your question earlier about bodies in here. So that's what Colonel Crozier said when he stood where I'm pointing now in that hole. Now, I have two things from that. The first one, I have a bit of an issue with the quote part where he said, some have been there for days. I can't say that.
No.
Because this is the 1st of July.
Yeah.
Prior to the 1st of July, the front line trenches would have been full of hundreds of soldiers doing their tour of duty, yeah, getting ready for battle. This trench would have been in and out of this trench all day.
Maybe because of the condition he thought they'd been there.
I think probably in the heat of battle, yeah, when you're trying to send men out to die, he probably just got himself a wee bit overawed by it.
Yeah.
I personally think because our division had got so far so quick, the casualties had to be brought off the battlefield.
Yes.
So rather than bring the casualties a half a mile to the dressing station, they knew that they could have put them in there and they would have been safe until they were gathered. So I think that's what happened, so that the soldiers could get back out onto the battlefield to fight with the rest of their comrades. So I think it's understandable. You know, he's starting
to...
It
wasn't planned, was it?
Agree.
They didn't plan it. They didn't think they'd have such heavy casualties.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. You know, so I think that's why this is probably not even an hour into the battle.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Half seven, this all happened so quick. Mm. Everything was done here by early evening, you know. Now, the second part of the quote, when he says he mounted the parapet to observe, the attack on the right come to a standstill. That was the poor old 32nd Division. Now, no trees. So he looked from this parapet and he could see all them soldiers on the barbed wire cut to pieces. And that's what he was quoting. They've sacrificed their lives on the German wire to the god of war. And that's what that guy seen that day. Absolutely horrendous. So that's the story of the 9th West Belfast Battalion. I'm going to jump back now to 2006, when another artifact was found in this trench when Teddy Colligan was doing a tour.
Just the spoon.
Yep.
A
and
spoon.
I don't need to ask you what this is.
The magic spoon.
So that was found in here in 2006. If you look at the handle on it, there's information on that. And the first thing you'll see is WRR.
Yep.
And then you'll see a set of numbers. I think it's 196682 or 23.
Something like
that. So that tells us the WRR stands for the West Riding Regiment, more commonly known as the Duke of Boots or the Duke of Wellingtons.
Okay.
So they were part of the 49th Division, who relieved our division in this wood on about the 3rd of July. The number tells us who owned it, and it belonged to a private William Hatfield, who was born and bred in a wee village in Derbyshire in England called Glossop. So young Hatfield joined the West Riding Regiment sometime after the 1st of July. He went out onto the battlefield where he was shot and injured just below the knee, where the spoon was.
That's
it was very common in them days for soldiers to tuck a spoon or a fork down their putty. They had putties up to below the knee.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is, if they had an opportunity to get a quick hot meal, the food was brought up to them, they don't need to take their packs off to look for this stuff. So they just pull the spoon out, have their dinner, spoon back in. So he was shot and wounded below the knee. He was brought back in through this trench where he lost that spoon. He was taken to the rear of the wood to the dressing station and consequently Kazovac back to the United Kingdom, where he convalesced in Oxford. At the completion of his convalescence, he came back out, but because of the injury, he was downgraded. He couldn't fight in the front line. He wasn't an A1 soldier anymore. He became a B2 soldier. He joined the Labour Corps, and he finished the war, and at the end of the war, he went back to Glossop. He died in 1956. So all that information we got of that spoon. Sam Scott, which the question was asked earlier, also survived the war. He was taken prisoner of war somewhere near St. Quentin in March 1918 on the spring offensive, but he survived to get home and he went back to West Belfast.
So both the owners of the artifacts that we've looked at survived.
And as I say to people, it's very, very hard to gain information on soldiers who survived the war.
Mm.
They went home, they didn't want to talk about it. Mm. They felt guilty because they didn't die. And for years and years, artifacts and stuff were hid in attics. So it makes us very, very lucky to have found these two for living soldiers. Mm. If a soldier dies here or he's missing here, we can find him if we have a bit of information, because it's easy, because there's records. But a lot of these soldiers that survived, no records, no regimental records. Birmingham. Oh, it was common for soldiers to get that done.
They didn't want anyone else to pick them up and use them.
Must have been a lot of thieves back in them days. And it was made in Birmingham, by the way. The other side says something in Birmingham. Not, I thought of one of them as Sheffield Steel.
Yeah,
but,
I can't quite.
But both them artifacts are probably, they could be 120 years old.
Yeah.
This is only the 1st of July we found. Yeah, I never found.
And do you think you must have had it that way facing?
No, no. It was facing up. And he got shot just above the knee. So that the spoon bit would have been up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's inwards probably.
That way, yeah.
Yeah, facing inwards, yeah.
The way it's shot.
Yeah.
So we would have had it like that.
Yeah. Guys, is there any questions on... We call this the Lucky Trench. We've one more to see,
yep.
And it's the one that I fell in. I'm not going to fall now. If you follow the path around, you'll see the poppy wreath there.
Yep.
And we'll finish off there.
Bear in mind, I'm stood next to him. If he falls, I fall. You got a bit close to the edge of that trench in there as well. I think now we're going to look at a mortar pit, I believe. Oh, boy, I mean, we've got to get up the bank here.
Right, see you tomorrow.
Yeah, I can. See your footmarks from a couple of days ago.
Into the trench.
It's a long way down from here.
Yeah,
we're a long way up.
I'm not going there anymore.
No, we're going to stay here, I think.
So, the third type of trench in this wood is this, which is called a mortar pit. This is a mortar pit. You can see the shape of it, the big round part at the front. Now, the 2-inch trench mortar, there's one up in our museum in the centre of the floor. It's more commonly known as a toffee apple or the plum pudding because of the big bomb and the big stick. It was a really, really rough, inaccurate piece of equipment. It wasn't really that good. I think at maximum range of a couple of hundred yards. And it was only used really to cut wire in no man's land. But the mortar would have been in underneath the roof there with the barrel facing out. At the bottom of the barrel, and we haven't got it up there, there was a 303 trigger mechanism beveled in, manufactured that way, not done by somebody, into the bottom of the barrel. So what you done, you had a wee bag of chordate explosive, and it went down the barrel. You then put the big toffee apple on, primed it, and checked that it was loose. Then you pulled the trigger, and off it went, sometimes. Now, on the trigger, at the bottom of the barrel, there was a lanyard. And the lanyard run along the trench and round the corner. So that's how they liked it. Now, this weapon wasn't fired by the infantry. It was fired by the Royal Artillery.
Yep.
And there was three men in the team. The number one, whose job was to put the cordite in. The number two, to put the toffee apple on and prime it. And the number three, simply, they all run round the corner. Number three, pull the lanyard. And sometimes off it went. I would not like to have been in them trenches 50 metres away when this thing's gone over my head, if I'm honest. And I think over the years, that's probably why we're not that keen on the Royal Artillery. Now, the Royal Artillery had in them days, and they still have today, a policy called shoot and scoot. So they would have fired three rounds in this trench. They then would have moved on to another one. And as I say, there's nine of these all along behind the front line. They'd have moved to the next one, fired three rounds, and so on and so forth. So that the enemy couldn't pinpoint their position and reciprocate.
Right.
However, if we're all honest, the Germans knew exactly where these pits were. So while the artillery's firing and running, the infantry's getting what the Germans are giving them. And that's another reason why we don't like the artillery. But you can see the difference in this one.
Yes, definitely.
And now, these sandbags, guys, just as you're looking at them, these were done in October.
Oh.
Look how that deteriorates.
Brand new in October. This was the only trench done in October. Have you any questions?
So other than to say where was Billy McFadgen in here at that point? We're not sure.
No. How long's a piece of string?
Yeah.
I'll tell you where people think he was.
Okay.
About 50 metres in that direction.
Okay.
And there was, people had come in here in the dead of night, and nobody's allowed in here because of the munitions in it.
Yep.
but they still come in, and they shouldn't come in. And they had a small memorial, a wooden cross, and some metal cap badges, which were quite nice. And that's where people thought he died. There's no proof of that.
There's no evidence.
However, that's all gone now. And the reason that's gone, last year there was an ice disease in this wood. And most of the wood you're looking at now, particularly at the front line, you couldn't hardly see out. Past that trench, in that direction, you couldn't even see in there. It's like a field now there. You know, if you've been here before recently, as a year, you would notice that difference.
That's happened in a lot of woods, hasn't it, on the Somme?
Yeah.
It's happened in other trains.
All the trees were, hundreds of them, were pulled out. The brought heavy plant in, out onto the road, and they were taken away.
That's absolutely brilliant, Rocky. Thank you very much.
Well, guys, I hope you've enjoyed that. And, you know, my two aims are, the first one is for 10 seconds you go out there and you look and you think, God, what a damn kid you go through. Yeah. And also think about the wee German soldiers. Yeah. And secondly, this gives you a good idea how soldiers had to live, what they had to endure before they went out, what we call a hell hole out there, you know. Absolutely. So brilliant. If you do that for a couple of minutes, then I've achieved my aim.
And for people listening at home, how can they, if they come out to the Somme, how can they get to see the woods?
We do tours daily, except for Monday. We're off on Monday. We do tours daily from 11 o'clock and 3 o'clock. Mm. It's advisable, particularly if you're in a group, to book through the Somme Association. Just Google them and book, and we'll put you in the electronic diary. Yeah. But we do walk-ins. If people come up, we certainly will accommodate them.
But sometimes you've got, you know, coach parties here.
Yes, absolutely. And quite a lot of people don't know we exist.
Yeah,
so we're trying to get the word out that people can come and see.
And people make a donation, don't they?
Yes, we ask for a donation towards our work here, as we are a charity. Yep.
Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much for your time.
Guys, great to see you, and good luck when you get back to Oz.
So there you go. That was great, wasn't it? Just listening to Rocky there, and he was talking and saying thank you to our Australian visitors that I was taking around the battlefields for a few days when I recorded that interview a couple of weeks ago. And in summary, let's just look at what happened to the 36th Ulster Division on that day, the 1st of July 1916. The Germans on the flanks turned their guns on the Ulstermen because the attacks, as we know, at Tietvale and Beaumont Hamel had failed. And the Ulstermen were caught in what's called enfilade fire from the side and also from behind. They were literally firing from behind where the Tietvale Memorial now stands. And over the 2 days of the battle that the division was there, they had 5,500 casualties killed, wounded or missing. And of these, around 2,500 of them, nearly half, had actually been killed or died of their wounds. And so many of these men had come from villages in and around Ulster. The losses had a devastating effect back home in Ireland. The division was withdrawn from the line on the 2nd of July, and they went up to Flanders on the Messines Ridge, and there they took part in the Battle of Messines. But that's another story for another day, and we will tell that story. We have told it, actually, in previous podcasts, but no doubt we'll return to that in the future. All it remains for me to do is to thank you for tuning in to this podcast, Tales from the Battlefields. Please continue to review, rate, subscribe, whatever else you have to do these days, on Apple, Amazon Music, Audioboom or Spotify. That really does help the podcast. And we're going to remember, as we always do, those Irishmen and the others that died later on in the battle, in and around the Tietvale Woods, the Shraven Redoubt, the Mill Road, all around that area. The Irishmen and those from the United Kingdom that followed them as they battled to take the Shraven Redoubt, which didn't fall into Allied hands until October of 1916. And we'll also remember the Germans that died there as well during the Battle of the Somme. And we do that, as usual, by playing The Last Post.